The views given on the following program are not necessarily the views of the station management or staff. Since individual situations can and will be different, please remember this when exercising any options presented by our guests.
Success is equated with excess. The ambition for excess wrecks us. As the top of the mountain becomes the bottom line, where success is equated with excess.
This is Care for My Wealth. With Chris Klein of Capstone Wealth Management, your fee-only investment firm. Now, here's your Care for My Wealth guy, Chris Klein.
This is Care for My Wealth here, Fox Sports 1070 The Game, hanging out this week as we do each and every week with Mr. Chris Klein of Capstone Wealth Management. You can get to know Chris and the team at Capstone Wealth Management all online. The website, careformywealth.com. That's careformywealth.com. Telephone number at Capstone Wealth Management, 866-596-9886. That's 866-596-9886. You can also email Chris. His email address is info@careformywealth.com. That's info, I-N-F-O, at careformywealth.com. Without any further ado, Chris, how was your Thanksgiving?
It was great, but you would think the day after Thanksgiving, people wouldn't be like in freak out mode with everything on a global scale, right?
Yes.
No, it was good. It was good. I commented to you offline. We didn't have any Griswold moments that I can share. And some of that's because we've hopefully planned for it correctly through the last several years of Griswold moments of, oven on fire, stopped up sink where water's going everywhere, blew up a microwave. Let's see, what else can I bring up? So from now on, I put a turkey on the grill and we keep it outside.
That's perfect. That is perfect. And as you mentioned, of course, the importance of not only learning, but then planning from those lessons. And that's one of the great things in talking with you every week, Chris, is kind of learning from experience. And, you know, people often say, well, you know, don't time the markets. You don't time the markets. And those are all, you know, these type of haphazard moves that people make and think, okay, it'll all work out in the end. Oftentimes you're just spinning your wheels and learning from and monitoring things and putting together that plan. That's really an important thing. So before we get talking, as you mentioned, kind of what's been going on globally in those equity markets, just real quick, let's talk a little bit about Capstone Wealth Management and a little bit about what makes you guys so unique and why the importance of planning and, of course, having an understanding and some guide rails and some other important things to really make things successful for you and the people around you?
I'll try to give the 30,000-foot view and then hone it in as best as we can as the show develops. So we focus all of our waking time on helping people, specifically risk manage portfolios, through as many markets as we can. We take a macro view, which means that we'll invest anywhere and almost in anything in terms of asset classes, equities, bonds, commodities, currencies, you name it, right? We'll go anywhere in terms of domestic, global, emerging markets. Doesn't matter. What matters is, are they in a certain spot on the economic sine curve? And does the signal suggest that it's the right time to be placing capital in that position that's in the right spot on the sine curve? And so when I say the economic sine curve, I mean mathematical composition, S-I-N-E, not signpost like S-I-G-N. And we basically want to know, as an economy, domestically or globally, wherever we're deploying capital, as an economy, is it expanding or contracting? In other words, is it accelerating or decelerating from their most recent comparable year-over-year numbers? And is inflation accelerating or decelerating from its most recent comparable year-over-year numbers? And the reason that's important is that if you backtest investing, what you can find is that if you invest in the appropriate economic cycle, growth accelerating, inflation accelerating, growth accelerating, inflation decelerating, those are the two most valuable economic quadrants in terms of being able to turn up the risk dial. When you want to turn the risk dial down is when you're starting to see growth decelerate along with, in some cases, inflation accelerating. You want to see the risk curve start to get dialed down if you're seeing growth and inflation decelerating. So it's very important to recognize where we are on the economic sine curve. The next thing that's important to recognize is that you have to have a guardrail that helps you to define when to make an investment. What you can't do is listen to the noise that's going on around you. And I'll tell you, yesterday was a noisy day. Now, you wouldn't think it would be. I thought, good grief, people not drink enough vodka on Thanksgiving?
They're that happens?
In all jacked up, just ready to be crazy? What is going on? And I'll explain what we think has took place, not just yesterday, but taking place as we move through here. But that guardrail, we basically define that as identifying price, volume, and volatility. In other words, anyone that's just going to look at price of something doesn't get a full effect of what's actually causing that price to make its movement. And more importantly, it can't give you an idea as to whether or not that price movement is likely to accelerate up or accelerate down. So that's an important element, the price, volume, volatility calculation that gives us an idea of whether or not the time to invest in something that is specifically well-structured for the current economic cycle that we're in is probably one of the most important elements. And so to your point, I think what makes us different is that we don't just look at a pie chart of something. We don't just, you know, we don't just segment people's capital off into some 60%, 40% model that's supposed to do over a long period of time really great. You know what? If you get the wrong kind of fixed income at the wrong time, it can be just as bad as buying the wrong equity holdings at the wrong time. And a lot of people don't recognize that. The bond market can be, in some instances, exceedingly volatile. And right now, we know it's volatile because the MOVE index, which controls treasury bond volatility, is super, super elevated. It's over 83. 83 in the MOVE index is ridiculous. It's like having the VIX, which is broad S&P 500 equity market volatility, well above 35. And anyone who knows anything about equity markets is that when you start to see the VIX, S&P 500 volatility spike above 35, it starts to become uninvestable. It's a very, very difficult market to mess with when volatility starts spiking out like that. Well, we're seeing that happening in the bond market. And all that does for us is it suggests that we are still in this economic quadrant that's referred to as quad two, growth and inflation accelerating at the same time. And the reason why we're saying that is because the year-over-year comparable for GDP and CPI is a number that, based on the current expectation for the Q4 data that'll ultimately come out after the first of the year, is that it's accelerating. It literally is just that simple, but it's accelerating. And some people might say, well, how do you know that it's going to accelerate? Well, you start to look at all the little pieces of the puzzle, right? All the items that go into the factors to help you calculate whether or not that acceleration or deceleration is taking place. And some really big components of the inflation cycle is not just, of course, oil and things of that nature that we see all over the place, but housing and obviously autos. Autos are a big deal. Well, auto inventories are sitting at a 93% below normal. I don't know, Sean. Seems to me that if I were a betting man, I'd probably want to suspect that those go up more before they go down more. There's not much more down they can get in terms of inventory. So we're very active in terms of helping a client adjust portfolios as we roll through these economic sine curves. And now every now and then you get what happened yesterday. And what was yesterday? Yesterday was a straight freakout by both retail, number one, and number two, what people don't see, and we have very, very good quantitative data that we know to be happening in the hedge fund community, that they are going through liquidations. Now, what does that mean? It literally means that they're on the wrong side of the trade, and the people running the fund are telling some of the people who are running subcomponents of that fund to liquidate their book. They get tapped on the shoulder, and they say, you're done. I don't want to be in that sector anymore. Or I don't want to be in those assets anymore. And they just dump them. They liquidate them. And so that's what you saw in small caps yesterday. It was more likely than not a forced liquidation that took place due to the hedge fund community being in illiquid leveraged positions and then being forced to sell. Why are they forced to sell? Because they don't own their duration. In other words, they get to a point where when they hit a certain level, whoever owns or structures that fund tells them what they have to do next. Those of us that run private money, those of us that are doing this not only for ourselves, but blessed to do it for so many people across the country, we own our duration. We don't have to sell when the rest of the world is losing their mind. You don't panic sell. That's what you don't do. And so far, what we saw yesterday, it was literally nothing more than a panic sell that we have seen so many other times take place this year. And what I would point you to, Sean, is you can open up a chart of the VIX, V-I-X, and just get a look at what the broad equity market S&P 500 volatility has done this entire year. Almost every single month of the year, going all the way back into November of last year, we would get at least one instance every month where the VIX would spike up to a level that caused the entire world to lose its mind and sell. They'd go to cash, and they do that at exactly the wrong time. Now, could it possibly be that the whole world's going to end tomorrow? Well, I don't know. But if it did, well, what does it matter? I'm not trying to be flippant. I'm just trying to point out the fact that when you understand how volatility moves, you can get a better glimpse into what's taking place. And so yesterday the news was, oh my goodness, the COVID variant is back again. And South Africa's got all these new cases that the whole world's going to end because COVID's going to go nuts again. You probably heard that on news feeds that were rolling around. Maybe? I don't know. Maybe you did.
Yes. Yes.
You did? Okay. Well, unfortunately, this is radio, so you can't see what I'm looking at right now, but I've got a list that shows the daily new quote cases in South Africa. Now, here's what I have a problem with. I have some connections with some scientists and some people whose intelligence quotient are way above my pay grade from a scientific standpoint. I have read enough papers and I've watched enough video feeds and interviews from very highly respected scientists that cause me, as a reasonable thinking person, to completely question every bit of what they're doing in the world of quote testing as it relates to this specific virus. And the reason I say that is that I have run into more instances than one with these very well, very highly respected scientists who have shown time and again that the test cannot define or delineate the difference between COVID, the common cold, the flu, or an old viral load that might actually be still in your body. Mm. We all do have those rolling around, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, if that's true, then the cases that keep spiking out are happening potentially under a false premise. Now, am I suggesting that no one's been sick with COVID? No, I'm not going down that road. I'm not suggesting that. What I'm saying is that you have to be very, very careful about buying and selling anything in the equity market or the bond market or the commodity market based on a narrative tied directly to what is or isn't happening with the whole COVID thing going on a global scale. And then what you have to do is you have to step back and ask yourself, all right, well, if these cases, and let's just call the case load that's happening right now to be accurate, don't know that it is, but let's presume for a moment that it is. Then you have to ask yourself, okay, well, comparatively speaking, if the world is suggesting based on the news feeds that it's a spike and it's the end of the world, and oh my goodness, it's going to be crazy, is it or is it not? So I'm looking at a picture of quote daily new cases for South Africa, because this is where the news feed is coming from now, going all the way back to February 15th of 2020. We saw one massive spike take place in June and July of 2020, another really big spike in December of 2020, another big spike in June of 2021. And just to give you a comparison, the difference between the big spike that they say is happening right now compared to what took place in June of this year, 2021, is that the daily new case spike that took place in June was about 26, 27,000. Today, we're lucky if it's running at roughly 1,000.
Oh, gee.
All right. So like everything that goes on in the world of investing, everyone wants you to get over emotional at exactly the wrong time. And that's how the machine works. The machine will squeeze you to the point of saying, oh my word, it is coming to an end. The world is literally coming to an end and I have to sell everything to protect my capital. And unfortunately, a lot of people do that because they don't have a good process to understand, one, what economic cycle are we in? Where are we on that economic cycle? And is the data accelerating or decelerating in both growth and inflation? And two, what is the signal saying? And the signal is specific to any one market that you might be looking at when you calculate price, volume, and volatility. You can't look at moving averages. Moving averages are a single factor type element that only give you one very small viewpoint of what's taking place. And that viewpoint is simply the movement of price. Well, price is a reflection of what's going on with volatility. Volatility and price come together to give you an idea of what's happening with volume. So you look at all these things together, and all we attempt to do for our clients is get ourselves positioned in the best place possible, not just for today or tomorrow, but more importantly, for the next 1 to 3 months. We want to be ahead of where the puck is headed, not behind it, right? So a couple of things that I think happened yesterday on this variant news that everybody lost their minds over, I think wrongly, but you know, we have to let time tell and let the whole world play its little whatever game is going on. But two things really, really stuck out to me yesterday, Sean. If the world was coming to an end, you would absolutely think that the riskiest of risky equity positions would be just getting clobbered, right?
Sure.
Oh, yeah. I mean, let's face it. If something is super, super risky, why would anyone want to be in that if the world was, in fact, coming to an end? They'd want to dump that as quick as they could. Well, there's an exchange-traded fund that's put out by a company called Renaissance. This is not a suggestion you go buy it. I'm just using it as an example. And its ticker symbol is IPO. Well, everyone listening, I'm sure, knows what IPO stands for. Initial public offering. Well, what is the fund? The fund is built with initial public offerings. Typically, the riskiest of those investments that trade on the open market. And the riskiest of investments that trade on the open market tend to be newer companies, literally just coming to market, right? Mm-hmm. But yet yesterday, IPO was up 1.34% on the day. And that's a day where we watched the S&P 500 go down 2.25%, on a day where we watched the NASDAQ go down 2.25%, a day where we watched the Dow go down 3%. Now, what I don't want anyone to do listening to this show right now is look at the Dow Jones Industrial Average in points ever again. If there's nothing that you learn from me other than to never look at the Dow Jones Industrial Average in anything other than points, that's that. Don't ever look at any index in points. Look at it as a percentage. Look at it on a percentage basis and ask yourself, okay, that percent took place. And everyone uses the Dow Jones Industrial Average. We don't really use that. And the reason we don't really use that is because it's 30 companies. Now, I understand. Everybody looks at that and says, well, yeah, but it's such a great representation of the global community, the global business environment. And I'm like, yeah, maybe. Maybe not. We've got to look at it a little bit more broader scale. And so we like to look at the S&P 500, the Russell 2000, and the NASDAQ. And when we do that, we never look at it in points. We're always looking at it on a percentage basis, number one. Number two, we're always looking at it on a perspective of price, volume, and volatility. And so when we do that, what we saw yesterday was all of those indexes trade below the low end of the calculated daily range of probable movement for all three of the indexes. That doesn't really happen when you're in the midst of a very strong quad two cycle, growth and inflation both accelerating. And until the data tells us otherwise, Sean, mm-hmm. we still are in a growth and inflation acceleration cycle where we are likely to not only see a movement upward in inflation yet, still happening through the end of the year, but also for GDP growth. And that's happening on a year-over-year scale. Now, how much is it going to happen between now and beginning of next year when it gets announced? Hard to know, hard to say. But if I'm looking at the end of the world, I would hardly doubt that IPO, filled full of IPOs, would be up 1.3% on the day, over 3.5% higher than where the indexes were. Would that make any sense to you if the world was coming to an end?
Not even a little, no.
No. Here's another one that tells me the world was not likely coming to an end. Gold. Mm-hmm. Now you can look at gold in the spot market, which would simply be seeing what the commodity, the actual yellow metal itself did, or you can look at a proxy, like an exchange-traded fund that holds gold. But gold itself was down about 0.05 of a percentage point on the day, 0.1, 0.05, somewhere in there. Now, let me think about this. If the world's coming to an end and everybody wanted to protect their capital, and if they believe, wrongly, by the way, that gold protects you against inflation, that's not how that works. Gold moves with rates. Rates up, rates down, all right? You're going to get a movement opposite of what we see going on in the rates market, more so than you will based on the expectations for inflation. But so many people have used gold throughout history as a, quote, store of value. And then when things get really terrible, really, really bad, we're going to buy a lot of gold.
It's going to go through the roof.
Yeah, right, right. Gold's going to go through the roof. Well, guess what? If gold was down yesterday, that doesn't seem to fit the narrative that the world's coming to an end and that we got to buy bunches of gold. Now, what happened in 2020 when everybody truly did believe that the world was coming to an end? Well, if you took a look at what took place with gold from, say, well, you can look right from the beginning of the year, January of 2020, all the way into the top of what we would refer to as the economic cycle, is that gold was up about 32%. It hit the changing of the cycle. We went from a quad three cycle, stagflation, deflation, quad four, all that sort of stuff was taking place in 2020. And then the cycle shifted right around end of July into August. Well, then all of a sudden gold from that cycle shift, right, roughly in say July, August of 2020 to where we are today, gold's down 14%. If the world was coming to an end, I doubt very highly that we would see gold down on the day, right? Much less down that much over the cycle that we're in. The other thing that we have to look at is interest rates. Now, last week, you might remember, one of the things that I commented on was that the movement in interest rates on Friday, not just yesterday, but the week prior Friday, had got to a point where it was very, very close to the low end of the calculated range of price, volume, and volatility for yields on the US 10-year Treasury. And I said that I wouldn't be surprised if interest rates spiked through the next week, which was this past week that just happened, to the top end of the calculated range, which at that point was about 1.66, 1.67%, 1.68% on the US 10-year Treasury. Well, on Monday, or excuse me, on Friday of last week, not yesterday, but the week prior, interest rates moved to the top of the range on Wednesday, all the way up to 6.93%. So interest rates did exactly what they believed that they should do when that occurs. So what did we do? Well, we lightened the load on our financials because financials tend to move consistent with the movement of US 10-year Treasury yields. And we got rid of all of our Treasury bond shorts. In other words, when you're short a US Treasury bond and yields go up, you make money. When yields go down, you lose money. So we got to the top of the range on the US 10-year Treasury, and I said, it's tapping the top of the range. What do we do? Dump all of our shorts, pull down some of our exposure to financials and regional banks and things of that nature, and let's just see what happens. Well, what happened yesterday? Yields fell where? Right to the bottom of the calculated daily range of price, volume, and volatility of 1.49%. Now, is it magic? No, it's not magic. It's math. Could we have predicted that interest rates did exactly what it did exactly at the time that it did? No, you can't predict the timing specific other than to say, all right, I'm at the top of the range or I'm at the bottom of the range. And when the math says we're at one of these two elements, I have to execute on that transaction. And for us, execution on that transaction was to say, all right, we're now at that level of interest rates yesterday, 1.49% on the US 10-year Treasury, that suggests at the low end, probability now tells me that it's going to go where? The other end. And the other end's now up to 1.69%. So what did we do yesterday when the world was freaking out? We bought some financials. I wasn't ready to short more Treasuries just yet, and that's only because the overbought, oversold conditions in the US 10-year Treasury yield market didn't click the way that I would have liked to see it click. And so, okay, you back off and you make a new decision. But the key is that it's never just one thing. It's a confluence of a multitude of things that helps you to recognize, are things happening that are literally going to affect the movement of the market over the intermediate term? Or are we moving into a completely new phase? Is the whole world now shifted into the point of saying, oh my goodness, I literally got to go to the bunker. The bomb shelter has got to protect me now because the world's falling apart. We don't see that happening yet, right? We just don't see that happening yet. And as I said before, if that was something that was happening, I way more trust markets than I do anything coming out of the mouths of anyone in government or anyone in the media. I don't trust any of them at all, ever, when it comes to money, not one. For years, Sean, I have told my sons, gentlemen, do 180 degree opposite of whatever you hear something coming out of the government and you'll do just fine. And I think the same thing holds true to understanding movement of markets. I believe markets, because they are functionally moving based on real-time information that is getting digested. But you have to have a process to that, and that process has to be disciplined. And then when the process is in motion, you actually have to execute on it, even when it's uncomfortable. And when you have a day like yesterday, yeah, that's uncomfortable. And every now and then you're going to get kind of spanked because you're just in the wrong spot at the wrong time for no good reason. But because we own our duration, we're not forced to do anything in terms of buying or selling, we can step back. We can ask ourselves, where's the strength? Where's the weakness? If that weakness is really weak, why is it weak? And then we can look at the math and tell ourselves, all right, the math is suggesting that that thing that's weak is weak for no good reason. It's at the level where it's saying we should be buying it. Execute. Time to buy. Or in some cases, time to sell. And that happens too. Every now and then you buy something and you follow the rules and you follow the process and you follow the math, and it just doesn't go the way you anticipated it to. No idea why. Don't really care why. What I care is if it broke the rules, then it's gonzo from the portfolio. And we've got a couple of positions right now where if next week it doesn't pick up the bootstraps, it's gonzo. And I don't care what why, I just don't want it around anymore. So we'll move it along and do something different.
Trusting the math. Talking this morning with Chris Klein. Of course, Chris comes to us from Capstone Wealth Management. You can learn more about Chris and the team at Capstone Wealth Management all on the website, careformywealth.com. That's careformywealth.com. Great resource to learn more about Chris and his team. The best way to get in contact with Chris is just to pick up the phone, give him a call. Telephone number 866-596-9886. That's 866-596-9886. 596-9886 for Capstone Wealth Management. And you can always email Chris. His email address is info@careformywealth.com. That's info@careformywealth.com. We'll continue our conversation with Chris. We'll talk a little bit more about where we should be positioned and, of course, a little bit more about this kind of global freakout that's been going on and what you can do to protect yourself. We'll find out from Chris more details on that next as Care for My Wealth continues here on Fox Sports 1070, The Game. This is Care for My Wealth here, Fox Sports 1070 The Game. Hanging out this week as we do each and every Saturday morning with Mr. Chris Klein of Capstone Wealth Management. You get to know Chris and the team online, the website careformywealth.com. That's careformywealth.com. The telephone number 866-596-9886. That's 866-596-9886. You can also email Chris. His email address is info@careformywealth.com. That's info@careformywealth.com. And Chris, one of the things that I see in the news, I see in the media, is that Strategic Petroleum Reserve. And we're going to release some of the oil there and leads me to believe that all is good now. Everything's fine. Problem solved. Time to move on. What are you seeing?
Yeah, no, not so much. Great question, though. You know, and it's a really good point, I think, that you brought up in that the media will play all sorts of insanity cards to cause someone to think something when the opposite is probably happening. And again, for me, whenever I hear something coming out of the mouths of government, I step back and go, don't care, don't believe it, got to move on, right? So let's put the Strategic Petroleum Reserve release in context, because I think this is a valuable thing for everyone to understand. So what did they do? Well, the Biden administration announced this week that they were going to release 50 million barrels from RSPR, Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Now, to the average casual ear, 50 million barrels sounds like, hey, well, that's a lot of oil. And, you know, volume-wise, yeah, it is a lot of oil. But it only equates to about 0.7% of so far this year, 2021's oil consumption in just the U.S., not to mention what goes on globally. So from a fundamental standpoint, it literally had zero impact. And I mean zero. I mean, how in the world is a 0.7% of our oil consumption going to have any net effect that quickly? It's not. The second thing to recognize is that they were releasing what we call sour crude, not the sweet stuff, right? So sweet crude, sour crude, it's the kind of crude is... It amounts to the amount of sulfur that the crude contains. Sweet crude has very, very low amounts of sulfur, whereas sour crude, which is not as desirable on the open market, has a really high level of sulfur in it. They released the sour stuff, not the sweet stuff, right? Third of all, I should say, is that we have to remember where we are in terms of inventories as it relates to U.S. oil. So in the U.S., obviously, we drill and we have oil and, you know, we put oil away and we sell oil globally and we use oil, right? Mm-hmm. Well, there's an inventory. And those inventories right now are down 11.4% on a year-over-year basis. And by the way, that's accelerating. That's not decelerating. In other words, it's going down faster. We're using more than we're buying, or using more than we're finding and drilling. I don't know if shutting down the pipeline has anything to do with that, but, you know, hey, let's not talk crazy, right? At any rate, the inventory cycle is not just down 11.4% on a year-over-year basis. It's actually below the five-year lows by about 3.1%. So now ask yourself, if our inventories on a domestic scale are down over 11% on a year-over-year basis, and we're over 3% below where the five-year low levels are for inventories, heading into two things. One, winter, and two, an expansion in economic activity. Sean, anytime you get an expansion in economic activity defined by an acceleration of the GDP number, you use more oil. It's just the way it works. Economic expansion requires energy. Energy requires oil. We cannot run our domestic or global needs on wind and solar at this point. It just doesn't work. And for everyone who wants to believe that we can just electrify everything tomorrow, well, guess what? That electricity has to be generated from somewhere. And the last time I checked, they're being generated from oil, coal, and other biotype fuels on an ongoing basis. We just don't have the capacity at this point. And hey, look, I'm a fan of solar and wind, and I'm a fan of all that stuff as it generates enough use needs, but we're not there yet. So you have to ask yourself, all right, well, what in the world was yesterday all about when oil was down over 12.5% on the day? Does that make any sense at all? And my answer is no, that doesn't make any sense at all. So what did we do? We bought more oil. It's that simple. We just bought more oil. Why? Well, the calculated range of the movement of oil when the day began, and I'm talking West Texas Intermediate crude, was from 73.04 to 83, roughly, let's say, right? What does that mean? It means that if we saw $73 for a barrel of West Texas Intermediate crude oil, we want to be buyers. If we saw 83, we'd want to be sellers. Now, last week, we didn't see the top ends of that mathematical range, and we were watching accelerations take place on top of the fundamentals of inventories being low. So we said, well, I'm not going to really sell much of our current oil holdings. We're going to kind of just let this play out. Okay, fine. So yesterday happens, and oil ends up on West Texas Intermediate going all the way down to $67.89 a barrel. Well, do you freak out and sell because it dropped below the level of the signal of price, volume, and volatility? No, you just execute on your process, which says buy more. And I can tell you this, West Texas Intermediate crude on a daily, and so we look at some different durations. Duration is just a time series, right? So one of the durations that we look at is 3 weeks or less, because the machine, Wall Street, likes to function on a month over month basis. And when something loses 1 month price momentum, the machine can cause it some grief, right? Well, at some point, the machine gets to the point where it's caused an oversold condition, both on a trade basis, 3 weeks or less, and even more importantly, on a trend basis, which is 3 months or more. And when you get an oversold condition in both of those time series durations, what it tells you is that there's a high and rising likelihood that we see oil go to the other end of the mathematical range. Now, two things happen to give you that indication, right? Volatility expands. When volatility expands, that range widens out. Well, goodness gracious, we saw some volatility in the oil market yesterday. I mean, OVX, and anyone can go look at this. OVX is the symbol for the out-of-the-box oil volatility segment that you just get a glimpse at to get a feel for how is this handling. Oil volatility had been trading between about 32 and 39. And so when it get to 39, it's like, hey, we're going to add some oil. You get to 32, maybe we'll sell some oil. But the range was so tight. Volatility was so condensed, contained, maintained, that that's the kind of asset class you absolutely want to have in your portfolio at those times. Can you predict a spike like what happened yesterday on who knows what kinds of news? The fact that they've got a 1,000 case increase in South Africa compared to 25, 30,000 in June? Okay, I guess if that's the way you want to invest, but I think that that's insanity. So OVX, the oil volatility segment, spiked up to 65. Now remember, I just said it had been trading between 32 and 39. So it doubles or got close to doubling in a day. Well, that's a lot. When volatility spikes like that, more often than not, it's a one-time freakout event. We call it episodic and non-trending. And I'd point you to a chart of OVX. You can pick it up anywhere. And you can go back and just kind of get a look at how OVX has traded with big spikes throughout this entire cycle. Now, remember, there's two types of time that we look at. There's clock time, which is market time, right? The time in which things trade on the open market, which for equities is from 8:30 in the morning until 3 p.m. Central Time. Yesterday was a shortened day. Markets closed at 1 p.m. Eastern. So that potentially had a lot to do with what we saw going on in the whole trading world. Who knows? Maybe traders were still hungover from Thanksgiving and they just weren't functioning right. I don't know. But look at a picture at OVX. Since the cycle of Quad 2, which is growth and inflation accelerating, first got in full gear, and that was November of last year. And in November of last year, we had one great big spike that took place right towards the beginning of the month at around 68. And then volatility just kind of kept falling off. And then we had a spike in February up to about 41. And then it fell off. And then we had another spike at the beginning of March at about 43. And then it fell off. And then we had another spike later in that month at about 65. And then it just fell off and just kind of traded volatilely up and down. Why did it trade volatilely up and down from about the end of March until about the end of July? It's because the economy actually rolled into a stagflationary cycle where growth actually decelerated in Q3 and inflation continued to accelerate. That's the definition of stagflation. So you had a few different spikes that took place there, all of which were buying opportunities in oil. In other words, if you looked at the spike that took place on, say, May 19th, the spike that took place on, June 17th, and I'm talking oil volatility, OVX, and you look at the spike that took place on, say, July 7th, and the big spike that took place actually on July 19th, all these were good buying opportunities. Roll that forward into the reprogression of Quad 2, growth and inflation accelerating in the end of September, beginning of October, and we had an OVX oil volatility spike again on October the 7th up to about 46. Go back and overlay that on a chart of West Texas Intermediate crude or Brent crude or any of these oil type proxies that you can look at. USO is an oil proxy that trades on the market. BNO is an oil proxy that trades on the market. Overlay that on top of a chart of OVX, and what you'll see are price dips at the time that OVX spikes. So probability gets on your side when you see a few different things happening. Number one, it goes to the low end of the signaled range of price, volume, and volatility. That's number one. Anything that gets to the low end of that calculated range increases its probability that it's going to go to the other end of that calculated range. So that's number one. Number two, when volatility spikes with really not an amazing amount of news that's going on, right? The second thing that we want to see is there an implied volatility premium? In other words, in the options market, are things getting priced in to suggest that consensus is buying puts, which would mean protection? If they're buying protection, more often than not, the opposite happens. Because when they get overprotected, they have to then unwind those trades and it acts like a little bit more buying. And we saw this happen in the energy market this past week. We saw that happen in the indexes, from the S&P to the NASDAQ to the Russell 2000, they all had massive spikes in implied volatility premiums, suggesting us in the marketplace of how options trade that people were overprotecting. Consensus was getting far too hedged. And when they get too hedged, things have a tendency to go the opposite way. Now, they got paid yesterday, right? Those that got super hedged into this Quad 2 cycle move saw yesterday as a big payday for them. What do we think? We think that they probably ended up getting shorter the market. We think that they protected more into that down move, which just exacerbates the high and rising likelihood that we see the opposite happen this next week. There's nothing that has changed so far, at least based on the data feeds that we get literally every day, to suggest that something is different in terms of our economic cycle, and more importantly, where we are in that economic cycle. So what we likely see next week is a fall off of volatility. That's our expectation. Our expectation is that volatility falls apart, prices spike. And when I say prices, I mean prices for most commodities, equities, and of course, in this instance, oil. One of the other things, Sean, that I didn't mention during the first segment that I think is valuable is the U.S. dollar, right? So the U.S. dollar has been on a tear. There's just no two ways about it. And I've talked about this a little bit. But if you look at how the U.S. dollar has done, oh, really, since June, the darn thing has just been really strong. It literally just doesn't want to fall. Well, if you have a freak out like what took place yesterday, you would have a tendency to ordinarily see the U.S. dollar even do better. And the reason why you would typically see the U.S. dollar even do better is because it's a safety trade. People still trust the U.S. dollar, even though it's depreciating, like, for the most part, right? With all the government spending and everything that's gone on, there's obviously some concern and nervousness. The dollar is not going to be worth tomorrow what it is today and things of that nature. We have seen an acceleration of DXY, which is the U.S. dollar index. But yesterday, the U.S. dollar was down 0.77%. Now, for a currency, something that moves 0.75 percentage point in one day is a lot. Well, if the world's coming to an end, why would dollars sell off? Wouldn't you think that if the world's coming to an end, people would want to increase their dollar holdings, the world reserve currency, the safest currency on the planet, which is still the case? And that's definitely the perception. Wouldn't you expect it to go up if the world was actually coming to an end? I would. We didn't see that. The dollar sold off on the day. Now, what's very interesting about that is that there is an inverse correlation to the U.S. dollar, Brent crude, and Bitcoin. What does that mean? It just means on a very short-term cycle, trade basis, 15 days or less in this instance, that the likelihood of the dollar going down causes a tailwind for both Brent crude and Bitcoin. But yesterday, again, what did we see? We saw Brent crude sell off to the tune of roughly 11%. And on top of that, we saw Bitcoin sell off. Now, granted, I know Bitcoin doesn't ever close, constantly trades. But in intraday, right, it closed down roughly, or it moved down rather roughly about 8%. But yet there's this inverse correlation that exists with Bitcoin and with oil compared to the U.S. dollar. Dollars down, oil and Bitcoin down. Well, that doesn't make any sense. So when you see these extremes happening, low end of the range, implied volatility premiums, way below the low end of the calculated range, by the way, oversold conditions on both trade and trend type durations, U.S. dollar correlations that aren't fitting the current movement of that particular asset class. What does all that tell us? It just tells us to keep executing on exactly the same process that we have executed on again and again and again and again for months and months and months and months on end. And that execution will always help us to move into that next phase if it happens. Now, could we see a complete change in the economic cycle? Well, if we did, we would have to see something take place that causes the GDP year over year calculated amount to start decelerating. I don't know that we see that at this point. Now, I get that there are a lot of global governments that are doing their darndest to cause people to go nuts by locking them down even more. Austria, Australia, as just two examples. But a lot of people are fighting that too. There are a lot of people that said, no, no more. I'm not doing this. You're not confining me to my home. In the United States, goodness gracious, look around you. It's busy. People are out and about. Have you been to a restaurant recently?
Oh, sure have. Had to wait. Yes.
Yeah, good luck getting a reservation in some cases. Yes. So people clearly want to get out. People are spending money. People are moving. Travel is happening, right? So there's an exchange-traded fund on the marketplace by the symbol JETS. Imagine what JETS holds. Airlines, yes. Right? Do we really think that just because cases in South Africa are now being reported to, quote, spike by, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, not even 1,000 at this point, that people are just going to globally stop traveling via airline? Sean, I don't see it.
No.
But yet at the same time, the JETS exchange-traded fund that trades on the open market was down about 7.2% on the day.
Ooh.
Why is that response that way? It's responding that way to what happened with oil, right? So you got this kind of movement, but more importantly, I think what it was doing is responding to the belief that the world is just going to lock down again like it did in March of 2020. And I don't see that happening. And the whole COVID narrative that's out there affected the COVID stocks. Companies like Zoom up on the day. Companies like Teladoc up on the day, right? Netflix up on the day. I mean, you go through the list of companies that had a tendency to do really well in the midst of the entire global shutdown, in the midst of the initial COVID response. Mm-hmm. And almost all of them were up yesterday because there was this narrative that, hey, the whole world's going to go there again. Now, what do you typically have on a Friday after Thanksgiving in terms of global equity markets?
Nothing.
You got a lot of novice investing going on. You don't have most pros sitting behind their monitors making movements into and out of global equity, commodity, and bond markets. Monday will be a very interesting day to give us an indication as to whether or not this freakout that we just saw, as shown and defined by VIX, VXN, which is the NASDAQ volatility indicator, RVX, which is the Russell 2000 indicator, OVX, which is for oil. Go down the list and look at these, and they all spiked right to like a ridiculous level. Monday will be very telling as to whether or not it was just, again, episodic and non-trending. In other words, an episode of a spike of volatility that ends up not converting itself into a trending fashion. And right now, again, all we can do is go off of the math, the data, the economic sine curve, and the signals. And when we do that, it's telling us that yesterday was not a day to sell, at the very least, not a day to sell, unless something that you owned was up, hitting the top of the mathematical range. We had a few things that did that. Natural gas. Natural gas was hitting the top of the mathematical range. What do? We sold a little bit. And I mean, just a little bit. And we'll wait for it to come back down and then we'll buy more. Oil was at the low end of the range. So what do? We bought more. Financials were at the low end of the range. What do? Bought more. I mean, there's a whole host of things that we looked at and said, goodness gracious, these are all good things to own in the midst of an acceleration of both growth and inflation coming into and through the remaining part of the fourth quarter. And let's not forget, right? Let's not forget that December and January have a tendency to be very good months for markets in general. And we don't look at seasonality per se as one of the factors that is a component in movement of how we think and deal with markets on a global scale. That's not part of that, but we acknowledge the fact that some major organizations do, and in some instances trade off of that. So you step back and say, all right, fine. So on average, December, January are good months. Fine. Put that in your back pocket on top of the fact that all the things I've already said suggest more likely than not a movement away from this level of low price and high volatility to higher price and low volatility. And at the end of the day, Sean, it would not surprise me one bit. It would not surprise me one bit if 1 month from today, we're seeing all-time highs again in the S&P, the NASDAQ, and the Russell 2000. Not too dissimilar than what we saw take place in volatility on September 20th and 28th of this last a month and a half ago. Not too different from that, where everybody went to cash when volatility spiked out. And we said, that's not the right move. You got to be buying into this because we're still economically in quad two, growth and inflation accelerating. And so when you do that, you then let it play out. And so it wouldn't surprise me if that happens. Now, if we go into a global freakout on pandemic and the governments of the world across the world shut everybody or attempt to shut everybody in their homes again, well, then I suppose me saying that's not going to timestamp so well. But at the end of the day, I don't think that that's going to be the case.
Hey, it's Chris Klein of Capstone Wealth Management. Of course, you can learn more about Chris and the team online. The website, careformywealth.com. That's careformywealth.com. The telephone number, 866-596-9886. That's 866-596-9886. And of course, you can always email Chris. The email address is info@careformywealth.com. That's info@careformywealth.com. Telephone number one more time for you, 866-596-9886. That's 866-596-9886. Chris, it's always great hanging out with you. You have a great weekend, and we'll talk again in just 7 days.
Thank you, sir. You do the same.
This is Care for My Wealth here, Fox Sports 1070, The Game.